Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, Setlist Live at Wide Days. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Chris Cook, and I don't normally do this bit of the Setlist podcast. Regular listeners will know that. Normally, my colleague Andy Malt will be doing this little introduction, so I don't quite know what I'm meant to be saying, but this is another unusual edition of Setlist because rather than us recording from our homes like we usually do, we're doing another live edition, recording it at another great music business event. So last week we were at The Great Escape. This week we're at Wide Days in Edinburgh, and that means that we have some guests joining us who are going to join me in discussing about some of the big music business news stories from the last week. So before we get going with our stories, we ought to get our guests to just very quickly say hello and explain who they are. So I have two guests, so I'm going to get Mike to introduce himself first.
Hello, Chris. Thank you very much for having me on this podcast. It's actually a favourite listen for me.
Yeah, you're a listener.
And you know I have an ambition to mint an NFT of Andy Malt talking about NFTs. That's the goal.
Regular listeners to Setlist will know that when Andy Malt, my colleague, is talking about NFTs, he's usually slagging them off. But so tell us about the company that you're representing at Wide Days.
Okay, hello. So my name is Mike Walsh, and I'm part of a business called Serenade, which is an eco-friendly music NFT platform. And yes, and I'm here at Wide Days to talk about that. And I've had a great couple of days in Edinburgh. I also manage a couple of artists and work for a couple of charities, work for War Child, and also work for a charity called Earth Percent, which is Brian Eno's music industry meets the climate crisis charity. That's pretty much all I have time to do.
That keeps you busy. Occasionally 45 minutes to come and record a podcast with CMU. Okay, let's get my next guest to now introduce herself.
Hi, Chris. I'm Shakayla, and I'm a first on this podcast, which I'm very excited to be part of. So I have a company called SNM Management. I manage four artists. They are Rebecca Garten, Kadeem Tyrell, Lavelle London and Kadiata, and they all sit across R&B slash hip hop. And I was also part of the MMF Accelerator.
Which is how we met.
Which is how we met, cohort from, 2021. So I'm excited to be at Wide Days and speaking with you.
Yeah, so we should explain for people listening, Wide Days is a brilliant music conference and showcase event that happens in Edinburgh every year. Edinburgh is a city which I love this city. I love coming back to Edinburgh, and it's such a great event. And the first full in-person Wide Days since 2019, obviously, for obvious reasons. So it's great to actually be in the assembly rooms, in a room with actual people. Thank you to Wide Days for hosting us. Right, so the format of this podcast is we've picked three stories from the music business news of the last week. I'm going to do a very quick overview of the story, and then I'm going to ask my guests some questions and get their viewpoints. So let's begin with good old Viagogo. The secondary ticketing website is back in the news this week. Maybe we just check before I get into the story. I mean, are we fans of secondary ticketing and ticket touting, or do we think it's evil?
Personally, I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan of sneaker resales. I'm not a fan of ticket resales. I hate anyone that takes something and like hikes the price up, which is like things that people love and they love to kind of collect. And they've made it like a competition for everyone. And I just don't think that's fun. And you end up getting people that, you know, really want to be part of something, but they now have to spend like five times the price. And it kind of takes the love out of, like, the original love that everyone had for something out of it. So I'm not a fan personally. Sorry, Viagogo, but not sorry.
Yeah, I think you would struggle to find people that are big fans of the secondary ticketing market in general. It's very divisive in lots of different ways, isn't it?
So my job in the Reasons of Balance is to be the defender of Viagogo, given that our guests have given the wise opinion that there are lots of issues with secondary ticketing. So let's see how I do defending Viagogo. I do occasionally talk to their PR people. Anyway, why are Viagogo in the news? So Viagogo, a often controversial secondary ticketing website. And obviously quite a lot of the secondary ticketing websites that used to be big news, well, two of them in particular, don't exist anymore because they were actually owned by Live Nation. Ticketmaster, biggest live music company in the world, biggest ticketing company. And then outside of the US, they bailed on secondary ticketing a few years ago because it just became too controversial. And that left us with StubHub and Viagogo. And Viagogo have always been the more controversial of the platforms, and for a while really had a, I don't know, their attitude seemed to be, we don't care what the music industry thinks. We don't care that artists don't like us. We're going to carry on doing this, and we're not going to answer our critics. Although in more recent years, they've tried to be a little bit more reaching out to the artist community, although as Mike alluded to, there are very few fans of for-profit secondary ticketing. So why are they in the news? Well, in various countries around the world, regulators have started to crack down on ticket touting, or ticket scalping, as it's called in some parts of the world. And Viagogo often is the one that they're cracking down on most. And in Australia, the Consumer Rights Commission there a few years ago basically sued Viagogo. They took them to court and they said, you're breaking consumer rights law. And there were three things in particular, if I remember rightly, see if I can remember what they were, that they took issue with. So back in the day, Viagogo would often use the word official in their advertising, even though the whole point of ticket touting and secondary ticketing is these are not official sellers of tickets. They're people who bought tickets from the primary sites and then they're reselling them. So it was the use of the word official that the consumer rights regulator took issue with. There was also the fact that it used to be on the Viagogo site. I don't know if it still is because I've not used it in a long time, but you would go in and pick a ticket and they would say, oh, these tickets are about to run out. You've got to buy it now. Otherwise, you're not going to buy a ticket. But what they meant was not that this show's about to sell out. What they meant was we are about to run out of touted tickets. And then the last thing, which actually is a criticism of ticketing across the board, is that all of the fees that they charge often or come at the end of the process, not the start of the process. So these are criticisms that have been made about Viagogo and indeed the wider secondary ticketing market for many years. Some sites, including Viagogo, have made some changes over the years, but when it all went to court in Australia a few years ago, the judge decided, yes, you have broken consumer rights law. They fined them $7 million Australian dollars. So although it's Australian dollars, that's still quite a lot of money, isn't it? And then Viagogo appealed, and so the ruling last week, the reason it was in the news was the appeals court basically said, nope, you broke the law, you did this deliberately, you did it on an industrial scale, hand over the $7 million was basically what they were saying. Do you think that, I mean, obviously the live sector is slowly coming back online, so in a way this hasn't been a story we've been talking about as much in the last couple of years, just because the live sector had other things to worry about. But do you think that, you know, you were talking about the challenge here, that we're pricing people out. Do you think it's still as big an issue today as it was 5-6 years ago? Or do you think that maybe with things like mobile ticketing, with Ticketmaster getting out, with the Ed Sheerans of this world being so vocal on that you don't touch Viagogo, it's not as big an issue as it used to be?
I'm not too sure, to be honest. But what I've realized is the people that love music, they buy the tickets, they want to buy the tickets, but they're already bought by, like, I guess they're called hackers. And that's what the problem is. So I think if you want to go to a concert, you're going to do anything that you can do to get those tickets. And that's what the actual issue is. I don't think the problem is the reseller itself. I'm all for resellers. Like, I've been sick sometimes and I can't go to concerts, so I would like to resell my ticket, but I'm not going to sell it for 10 times the amount, and that's the actual issue. So I feel like if there is a reseller, it should at least be capped. Okay, even if you want to maybe get like a little £20 on top, fine, but I don't feel like you should be able to, you know, sell something that for 3 or 4 or 5 or sometimes even 10 times the amount. It's a bit unfair. That's my issue.
No, and that's an important distinction to make, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Is that when you look at the resale platforms, Some people genuinely bought the tickets intending to go. They can't go. It's a no refunds policy at the show. So they're like, okay, well, I'm just going to try and sell them on. Versus the people who they are in the business of hoovering up tickets as soon as they go on sale and then reselling them. And you often felt back in the day, the Viagogos and StubHubs of this world were kind of using the genuine resellers as a sort of a justification for the industrial touts, even though all the stats behind the scenes were telling us that the vast majority of the tickets on those platforms were coming from the industrial touts. And I guess an innovation we have seen in recent years is some platforms coming to market with that cap. You can only upsell 10%, which means no one's going to be using that as a business. It's genuinely there for when people want to, well, they wanted to go to the show, they can't, and they just want to make their money back.
Twicket, is that one of the ethical ticketing platforms? Yeah,
capped platforms, yeah.
Totally, which actually you believe then when they say this is serving a fan need as opposed to, you know, as you say, you know, operating something which just feels a bit unseemly on an industrial scale. I guess my big question is, did Viagogo actually turn up for the court case? Because didn't they famously not turn up to the inquiries in the UK?
Yeah, so here in the UK, they did turn up to the court cases in the UK, but they famously did not turn up to the committee hearings in Parliament. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, the secondary ticketing has been a big talking point here in the UK for many years, and the industry rallied around a thing called the Fanfare Campaign, which really, you know, got... There was a period where the politicians were kind of hands-off on this, and they were like, it's not for us to regulate. The industry should regulate. And then with the Fanfare Campaign, the industry said, what can we do? You know, you need to regulate. And then some supporters appeared in Parliament, and yeah, there was two select committee hearings where they called on StubHub to come, and they famously did not show up both times. Although once the Competition and Markets Authority actually went legal, they did show up in court. But it was interesting that after this judgment last week in the Australian courts, Viagogo put out a statement saying we politely disagree, but I suppose more importantly, they were saying, oh, but this is 5 years ago that all these issues were there. Maybe they were right, maybe they were wrong, but we've changed our sights since then, and it's all fine now. Although the campaigners like the Fanfare Campaign say, yes, you have made some changes. Maybe some of that confusion has gone, but there are still issues with these platforms. You're still confusing people into buying tickets at a hiked up price. Yeah. And actually, we need more regulation in more countries to try and stop this.
Yeah, and it was really interesting in that story as well that the Fanfare guys were saying that they were hoping this would inspire some kind of heavier UK action as well, because, you know, there hasn't been any real, you know, successful action taking place. So, you know, fair play Australia for being ahead, actually.
Yeah, so here in the UK, for years and years, nothing happened. Then on the back of the Fanfare Campaign, and there was a government review and all the stuff happening in Parliament, there was a bit of progress over a number of years. But I do think quite a lot of the people who've been campaigning on this feel in the last two or three years that we've kind of stalled, and that there is more that the regulators could be doing. And okay, during the pandemic, it sort of went down the priority list. But as shows come back, actually, we need to get campaigning about this again. I said I was going to be Viagogo's defender. I guess the other thing that some secondary ticketing sites, or indeed the touts that actually buy up these tickets, will say is, well, actually, primary ticketing has problems. And that primary ticketing sites add these commissions. And particularly in the US, often a certain portion of the primary tickets actually go off to brand partnership deals, and the American Express customers get access to them, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the sort of defenses is, oh, well, you're constantly slagging off secondary ticketing, but the real problem is primary ticketing. And do you think that that's just a distraction tactic? Or do you think that maybe there are actually some things with official sellers that we could do better?
I mean, it is a complicated debate at the high end, isn't it? So when you get to like the Eagles and Paul McCartney and the Rolling Stones, there is a lot of money on the table because there are very rich people that want the front row. And, you know, you hear people like Ervin Azoff talk about how he tried to kind of, well, actually not tried to, he did, like, you know, revolutionize the kind of economics of touring when he took the Eagles out and they tiered the tickets and they were very expensive tickets, but they made an absolute shed load of money because guess what? That audience wanted to pay for those really good seats. So I get that. That's just market forces, and I would understand that as a part of the debate. But what I do love, which is almost an aside, is what some artists do, and I believe McCartney and Springsteen both do this, where they will hold back some of their front row so they're not performing to a load of hedge fund managers, and they give on the night those front row tickets to fans at the back of the room who then get upgraded for free and have the night of their lives because they didn't expect it. And it just makes a better vibe for the artist, obviously.
Well, exactly. There's a double thing there. A, those fans then love you and they're going around saying what a great artist you are. But yeah, exactly. You get to play to an enthusiastic front row. Yeah.
And I'm not saying that hedge fund managers aren't enthusiastic, but you know what I mean. I'm sure there are some really enthusiastic hedge fund managers.
But I think there are some issues with the primary ticketing market, which, you know, to be fair, some ticketing platforms and especially startups in the space have been trying to innovate with. And I think we're finally getting to the point now where mobile ticketing is becoming the norm. And it's taken a long time because everyone was always nervous of making it compulsory to have a smartphone to enter a gig, which was a legitimate concern. But we are now getting to the point where, yeah, I mean, I think there were some festivals last year where it was compulsory mobile. You know, if you haven't got a mobile with a ticket on it, you couldn't get in. And I think mobile ticketing, A, actually potentially provides some safeguards against touting. But B, it also brings some flexibility into the primary market. For example, there's that thing where it used to be that if the ticket buyer couldn't attend the show on the day, but they bought tickets for their friends, sometimes there were some issues about transferring the tickets over, whereas the mobile experience now is making it much easier to do that. So I think there are some legitimate concerns on the primary ticketing side, but there are some interesting innovations in that space. So I don't think I did a very good job of defending Viagogo there. Let's just all agree that they are still the Mavericks.
I mean, even that's a euphemism. Go those Mavericks.
Well, it was a few years ago when they finally came back to the table and started responding to the critics, having just ignored everybody for 5-6 years, including that, you know, not showing up to Parliament. They did then return with a sort of, oh, we're a startup and we're learning. And it's like, you've been going for 12 years.
You're worth like $3 billion or something ridiculous.
And, you know, I think it was a given that you shouldn't be tricking people into buying overpriced tickets. So anyway, that was this week's Viagogo story. Let's move on to story number two. Okay, so another thing that happened last week is that Universal Music's DIY distribution service, which is called SpinUp, announced that it was revamping and changing what it does. So SpinUp was a service a bit like TuneCore and CD Baby and DistroKid and Ditto, etc., owned by Universal, and it originally launched in Sweden, and then it rolled out into a bunch of other countries, including the UK, although it never really took off here in quite the same way it did elsewhere in continental Europe. And so it was a basic distribution service. You pay a little bit of money, they get your music onto the streaming platforms, they hand over 100% of the royalties. So that was the service up until last week. Mm-hmm. Last week, SpinUp announced that they're changing their model. And they're not going to be a platform that any artist can use. They're going to be an invite-only platform. So I guess that makes them a little bit like AWOL, which is another DIY distributor which has always distinguished itself from all the others by not allowing any artist to use their service. There has always been an A&R process in selecting what artists they'll work with, or sometimes actually AWOL generally pick people through industry recommendation, a manager or a lawyer or whatever pushes them forward. AWOL, of course, now is owned by Sony, so maybe that's made Universal look at that model. And so SpinUp announced last week, okay, we're shifting over to this model. We won't be providing services to anybody. We're going to be invite only. And as far as I can see, only a small portion of their current customer base are getting an invite. So there's a chunk of people, I don't know how many, but a chunk of people currently using SpinUp as a distributor who are going to have to find a new distributor. I think they've got 2 months. So basically they got an email saying, yeah, we're not doing this anymore, so you better go and find another distributor if you want your music on the streaming services. And they had an FAQ, and my favorite bit on the FAQ was, we're becoming an invite-only service. Do not ask us for an invite. Don't call us, we'll call you. So interesting development in the DIY distribution space. I mean, first of all, maybe I'll start off by asking Mike, I mean, aside from the fact that there's presumably quite a lot of annoyed artists now who've suddenly lost their distributor, but do you think actually that does sort of make sense in a very crowded marketplace to become a little bit more curated?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, without knowing the details of that, you know, this particular business, just looking at it from the outside and reading that story, it does make sense. You know, 60,000 tracks a day uploaded to streaming services, you know, it's a very long tail, but how much value is there in the tail as it gets thinner? So you do wonder if, yes, they were able to take money from a lot of artists who didn't really have much of a shot, I guess, and then they just have to think about one of the original purposes of the purchase, I believe, was that it was some kind of like scouting farm for A&R. And I think in one of the stories about it we read, it was 80 artists out of 100,000 had made it through to a frontline Universal label, which isn't a huge percentage over the length of time that they'd been operating. So I guess you could say that it wasn't really working as a scouting feeder system either. And yes, I also agree with what you say about AWOL, which is clearly looking a bit like a best-in-class version at the moment and will get even more resource when it's part of Sony. So yeah, looking at what they're doing, I'm sure was a big part of the UMG decision there.
Yeah, that talent scouting was definitely, when they first launched, that was very much I think I'm right in saying originally it was free. Okay, and so they entered the market doing it for free, and ultimately they started charging fees like everyone else. But the fact that, yes, our A&R people are watching the music being uploaded, so maybe you'll get signed to Universal, was part of the sell. But clearly, well, and inevitably, you know, a very small number of artists were ever going to be escalated up the hierarchy.
And actually, sorry, just one more point on that, which was that I also remember when that first started and I was working in radio, and I would have lots of artists tell me they were signed to Universal. so that was always an odd one to unpick, and you were like, okay, what, which label? And then it's da 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 da, and then you work it out, you know.
That's very clever, very sneaky of those artists. So Shakela, let's talk about the artists you work with. So I think I'm right in saying that they are working with these, what we call DIY distributors.
Yeah. So originally, Rebecca was under AWOL before she actually got signed to a record label. Kadiata and Kadeem both distribute through Ditto at different levels. And then Lavelle was signed to Believe, who distributed through TuneCore, but it was still a distribution contract with label services as well. So we've kind of worked with all of them.
And I mean, obviously with CMU and our CMU DIY program, I do lots of sessions with early career artists, and I talk about digital distribution, and it's like, okay, these are the services that can get your music onto the platforms. And often those early career artists will say, oh, which is the best? Which one should I use? And I never really know what to say. I mean, do you think ultimately they're all providing the same service, or are there certain ones which are offering a little bit extra?
Yeah, so there's two ways to look at it. Some of them have like relationships with DSPs, so like Ditto does, TuneCore do as well. So sometimes it's easier to get your artist pitched, but if you're coming in really, really early and all you're doing is kind of like uploading and looking for a digital distributor to get your music out, they all pretty much do the same thing and get you onto the same platforms until you start to, like, you know, rack up some plays, and then you can then reach out to the distributors like Believe, like Ditto, and say to them, oh, is there any way that I can get some money behind it? Or if they don't put money behind it, they might still put their services behind it for like a small percentage. But what they'll do is then they'll start to get, some of them have like radio pluggers, some have PR involved, and some have like people that actually will put you as a priority artist on their DSPs. So there are benefits from being on like a higher level, sometimes on a higher tier, they call it, with distributors, without having to sign over your masters.
And I suppose I often think with artists, it's understanding that, yeah, so at a base level, they're all delivering your music to pretty much the same platforms. Mm-hmm. And some will have slightly different pricing structures, and some they charge fees up front and then they give you 100% of any royalties. Some take less up front, but then they take 10% of the money down the line. But at a base level, they're all offering pretty much the same service. So actually, one thing I often say is, well, some of these services have staff in the UK and some don't. So actually, we're here in Edinburgh at Wide Days. The Emu Bands guys are out there in the foyer. They're based in Glasgow. So they have a UK office. They have a UK phone number. They operate on a UK timeline. Whereas some platforms are in the US. They only have an email address and they work New York or LA hours. So sometimes it's like, you know, okay, well, do they have a UK presence? So then you've got Ditto's a UK company, Root Note's a UK company, and TuneCore, CD Baby, although they're American, they have people here. So, you know, at a base level, that would be the only bit of advice I would give is, you know, that day you've got a launch party and you did your uploaded your track 3 weeks ago and it's suddenly not showing in Spotify, but your launch party is about to happen. Having somebody in the UK you can contact will be really useful. But I think that point you're bringing up there is it's also understanding that some of these companies have different tiers available. So obviously AWOL, that's one of the things they do. Ditto, likewise, with TuneCore Believe, sort of its TuneCore base level and then going up to Believe. And so, yeah, as your career progresses, but you're not yet ready to actually sign to a label, either because labels aren't yet fully interested, or maybe you don't want to sign to a label, some of the companies can offer those extra services as you're working your way up. So I think with your artists working with Ditto, they're not just on the baseline, they're getting those extra services.
Yes, they get extra services. So one of them doesn't take any money. They just, I think they have a percentage that Ditto take a percentage. They don't give them any money. So if we wanted like the Ditto team to, for instance, run ads, we can pay Ditto. They'll just run.
But they would bring the expertise to the table, exactly. But it would be your budget.
Exactly, but it will be under our budget. The other tier that one of them is on, they got a small investment and that's just to help with their marketing. They take a bigger percentage of the royalties. And we're okay with that, because we can see it start to pay off. And we didn't want to take a huge amount of money from a label because he still wanted ownership over his stuff. So we just took money where we needed it, basically.
And I think there's two reasons why it's good for DRA artists to be aware this is something that happens. A, because that might be why you pick a distributor, because like, okay, I'm ambitious, things are going to build, maybe I'll want some of those extra services or maybe even some cash investment. So I might as well start off with a company that has that add-on, whether that's within the company like with Ditto and AWOL, or it's because TuneCore maybe can elevate you up to Believe. But I also think it's worth knowing that, because I think sometimes people meet artists who are on AWOL or the higher level of Ditto, they hear about all these extra services and like, oh great, I can get that. And it's explaining, oh no, at the base level, you're just getting distribution.
Yeah. Yes, and as most music companies do now, they look at your numbers and they see how much you're going to bring in and whether it's worth kind of investing their time basically into what you're doing and if it's worth pushing your artist. But they have been a really, really good help, and they do have very, very similar resources to what you would get as a if you were to sign to a label. So I think once you're at that point and you're deciding whether you want to keep your masters or if you want to sign to a label, I'd look at both and really think about what you need. If ownership means a lot to you, then you can decide on what you want to do and what kind of contract or agreement you want to enter into with a label or a distributor.
And then when you really get to scale, so you're like a Georgia Smith on Orchard, or you're a Jerry Cinnamon on AWOL, or a Little Sims on AWOL, you're getting an incredible amount of service, I imagine. Like, you're getting very well looked after with all the expertise they have globally. They might not be slapping down a shed load of money for tour support and Brits appearances and whatever, but actually, by that point, hopefully your business is healthy enough because you're owning your own rights. But, you know, the support they get, I believe, is very rich, you know, because they are then the poster people for that model.
I mean, I suspect that SpinUp, now they've reinvented themselves, will start adding these extra tiers in. And maybe one thing they've recognized is one of the reasons why a relatively small number of SpinUp artists ended up being signed to Universal labels is it's a big leap to go from basic distribution on Spin Up to sign into a Universal label. So maybe within the Spin Up system, just like AWOL, they'll have Spin Up Basic, then they'll have Spin Up Plus, and then they'll have Spin Up Services to help build the artist's own labels to get them to something that maybe Island does want to sign them. So I suspect we're going to see that. But of course, in the short term, we've got a lot of pissed off Spin Up artists. I think not so much here in the UK, because as I say, it wasn't a big deal here in the UK, but I know elsewhere in Europe. And I mean, I just want to ask Mike a different question here. I mean, you mentioned at the start, so you're working with the music NFT platform Serenade, and we're constantly being press released new NFT services, some of which are general, some of which are music specific. But I guess lots of artists who are sort of dabbling in the NFT space for the first time are facing a similar challenge, aren't they? Oh, look, there's now 2, 3, 4, 7, 9, 15 platforms to choose from. How the hell do I know what to choose? Now, obviously, they should choose Serenade. That's clearly the answer.
You beat me to the really obvious answer, sorry, but yeah.
But I guess if artists are looking out there for potential partners in that space, are there certain questions they should be asking, things they should be looking for in terms of... Because, you know, often when we invest time into building these relationships and figuring out how these platforms work, our hope is that maybe we're going to be working together for a few years and we don't want to sign up for a platform that then disappears next month or which changes its business model next month.
Of course. And, you know, it's a really good question. And I think one of the misconceptions probably about NFT digital collectibles, as you will know if you've listened to any of the panels and stuff I've done past couple of days, we're almost kind of edging away from NFT and just talking about, you know, digital collectibles, digital merchandise, etc. And I think one of the main kind of misconceptions about the whole space is that if the company you're minting your goods with on blockchain disappears, your assets disappear, and, you know, you've lost that investment and that's the end of the story. And of course it's not, because they're still held on blockchain, and certainly in our case they're held on something called the IPFS, which is the Interplanetary Filing System. Genuinely, that's what it's called. And I don't want to go down any crypto rabbit holes today on this podcast, because I'm sure Andy Malt would probably edit me out anyway. But you know, these assets do live digitally forever, and that's the idea of these decentralized platforms and these, you know, this tech that's greater than my brain can understand.
But and I suppose, just to clarify, and that's why the actual NFT bit, the token, I mean, and it's interesting that you said the panel that we both did together earlier, that, you know, we're almost feeling now that people are being put off by the term NFT and are more excited about the digital content and experiences locked to the NFT. But crucially, why the token is important, that we're not just buying some digital content, the token is important exactly for this reason, that the platform that you're buying it from is not necessary for you to continue accessing and enjoying the content. And so you get that guarantee of future use and access.
Yeah, exactly that. And then back to the other part of the question in terms of an artist looking for which NFT platform to use. I mean, obviously I'm going to be biased towards what we do at Serenade, but it is the idea of finding, I would say, certainly if you're a musician, wanting to find a platform that knows music. And again, I think, you know, it's something that we've discussed as well today and yesterday, which is that people that are from the music industry in this space are definitely going to be the people that artists are going to want to and should speak to, because they're not just having a go at the space without thinking about the rights, without thinking about the ownership, without taking the copyright very, very seriously, which we do obviously at Serenade and others in the space do also. So that's a fairly obvious thing to say, is that not all NFT platforms are music native. Hopefully they're NFT and music native, but you don't always get both. And we're very lucky at Serenade. We have people from the music industry who we work with, who advise us, and we've built it from that perspective, and actually building it within the music industry's current infrastructure as well. But then also you've got other questions. You've got environmental questions that artists might want to ask, which we have plenty of answers to that I won't go into today on this podcast. But and then also probably the most obvious thing is you do need to just like the people you're working with, because at the moment, before we get into a self-service world for NFTs, which certainly for us is around the corner, things are quite it's quite hands-on. So we are going quite deep with artists of all levels to work out what story they want to tell, you know, what the pricing, what the scarcity is. So you spend a lot of time with them. So you need to be able to trust the people you're working with, is a very obvious thing to say.
And unlike digital distribution, where it is certainly at the basic level, everyone is selling the same service, obviously the add-on marketing promo is where you get the different companies doing different things. But at the moment in the digital collectible NFT space, everyone is still experimenting and working out what works and what doesn't work. So almost as an element of, well, what artists are you already working with? Because then I can learn from what they did and get an insight on, yeah, that worked, that didn't work. Okay, so Spin Up is now a different business, and who knows how many annoyed Spin Up artists there are out there. Okay, I've got one last story. I've just got a few minutes left that we wanted to bring up. So for those of you outside of the UK listening to this podcast, it is we've got a big celebration coming up in this country, which is the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, and we get 2 days holiday extra because of this. And for those of you who aren't in the UK, with these big royal events, half the country gets incredibly excited about this, and half the country can't quite work out what the fuss is about. But there's a music element to the upcoming Queen's Platinum Jubilee, because last week, Warner Classics announced that it's commissioned a new recording of God Save the Queen. And to clarify, that's not a cover of the Sex Pistols classic. It is.
Unfortunately, because that would have been the perfect.
So who's on this? Let me go. It's Sarah Brightman, Alfie Bowe, the NHS Voices of Care Choir, and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra are doing a version of our national anthem. I always like to say that the British national anthem really is Bohemian Rhapsody. And, you know, the only people that have ever managed to get any emotion out of our actual national anthem was when Freddie Mercury was dropping around on stage to God Save the Queen. But anyway, there's this new version coming out. They're aiming for number one in Platinum Jubilee Week. Meanwhile, Universal Music are re-releasing the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen. And obviously the story of that track is that when it was originally released for, I think, the Diamond Jubilee back in the 70s, it was very controversial that this punk record was being released called God Save the Queen when we were all meant to be, you know, excited about the Queen's Jubilee. So they're releasing, albeit limited edition, vinyl. So I don't think it's going to bother the chart much because they're not releasing very many. Plus, okay, this is one for everybody to be aware of. On top of that, a band who have tried to get to the Christmas number one in recent years, known as The Cunts, are releasing a special Jubilee single, which is called, and I quote, well, this is the title, Prince Andrew is a Sweaty Nonce, is the name of their song. And they have said that they're aiming for the number two. They don't want number one. So that will be going up against this new version of God Save the Queen and the re-release of the original. Do you think that chart battles beyond Christmas number one, are they a thing anyone's interested in anymore? Or is this just some opportunistic people trying to create some PR that nobody really cares about?
I think, no. I don't feel like chart battles are relevant anymore. I do think, though, in the black music space, that sometimes we want to push our artists just to get that recognition. So to get a number one, or to get a number, even just to get a top 10, where for a long time we weren't able to, that is really relevant. However, once we get to that space, everyone's like, yeah, we did it. Okay, so back to normal. It's just an achievement that we want to. But I don't feel like back in the day, when I used to watch Top of the Pops and we used to like want to tune in to see who's number one for this week. I feel like there's weeks and weeks that go by, and even as someone that works in the music industry, I have no idea who's...
Because I don't know who's currently number one in the UK charts. And I guess, yeah, I suppose, so it's still, you know, for an artist to be able to say, my number one single, my chart-topping album is great on socials, it's great in PR, but actually in any 1 week, most people don't really know what's in the chart anymore.
And I think it's true about the album versus the single as well. I think there's maybe just a little bit more meat on getting an album number one. And I totally see what you mean as well about genre as well, because it's like, you know, like when Diggity gets a number one, you know, when Gets and Gigs get up there, I mean, that's a really big deal for the culture, right? Which is amazing. And I think that's, you know, I think that's really important. And that's when labels really do their job well, you know, in terms of making sure that there's enough of the right physical product and all the pre-sales are in place and all the rest of it. And then also in the kind of the indie rock world, which I guess I come from, from. It's like, you know, when, you know, you get a Snuts or a Lathams or an inhaler to number one, it's kind of, you know, it's just it. I guess we like to convince ourselves that it's proofing some health in the genre. You know what I mean? When you do have some, you know, commentary in the mainstream, it's like guitar music's dead or whatever. And it's like, well, we've got a band from Wigan that no one's ever heard of called the Lathams, just got a number one album, you know, so that's great. So, and we do also know, if we're being realistic, is that there are lots of, you know, tricks and methods in order to get, you know, even a modest sized fan base, you know, activated to help you with that week one, and you get the number one, and then there's a 30% drop off week two, and that's fine because that's how the chart is now. You know, it kind of churns a bit when, you know, when it comes to albums, but it is still a marketing moment. And, you know, I know from the label's point of view, it's an opportunity to go back to radio and say, we've got a number one album. It's an opportunity to go back to DSPs and say, we've got a number one album. So I can see why it's chased so much, but I agree with you both on the singles. I don't really know what number one single is now working music.
I also think when Universal announced they were doing the re-release of the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen, it was a massive deal back in 1977, I guess, when that happened. And to the extent that actually there are two versions being re-released, because A&M, that's a mouthful, isn't it, as was, originally released the track, then it was such a scandal that they unreleased it and deleted it, and then Virgin Records stepped in and released it. So there were two versions, and they're actually re-releasing both of those versions and the packaging around it. So that's how big a scandal it was back in the day. And obviously there was always the conspiracy theory that it was actually number one and that some stuff happened behind the scenes to make it number two in the charts and all of that. And yet when they announced they were sort of re-releasing it for the Platinum Jubilee, it almost feels like it is an official event. It's sort of almost quite twee that this track is being re-released. Although maybe they went for the limited edition because they didn't want to enter a chart battle in that case. Maybe that's why they did it. Oh, well, we will see who is number one on the Platinum Jubilee Week, which is coming up. That is all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. So I want to thank both of my guests. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Here at Wide Days in Edinburgh. Thank you to Wide Days in Edinburgh for allowing us to take over one of their rooms to record our podcast. Obviously, I'm here, so I can't do the normal edition with Andy. This was the only way we were going to get a podcast out this week. So that's very exciting. I think I'm right in saying we are back to the normal format next week. We obviously did take a couple of weeks off because I was so busy with Great Escape stuff a few weeks ago. So we'll be back to the classic Setlist formula next week. So do all that stuff that Andy always says at the end. Sign up, subscribe, like, give us a good review on the Apple Podcast app or whatever it is that you're meant to do. You can email us at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. And I'm going to get to the end of the notes because I can't remember what it is that Andy says at the end. I think what he says is, Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com. Thank you very much.